Welcome to another episode of Mad in Germany. I'm here with David de Jong, the author of the now almost, I would say, seminal book, Nazi Billionaires, which looks at the ways in which much of Germany's wealthy families, many of them made their fortunes in the Third Reich. Book came out 3 years ago. I was a huge fan of it before, and we've actually mentioned it on this podcast before, but David's in town. We thought we'd get him on. So welcome to the podcast, David.
Thank you, James. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, David, it's 3 years since the book's come out, and you've stayed a little bit on this beat as well, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I can't seem to rip myself off of it. I've been on this beat, basically, on the Nazi billionaires hunting beat since 2012. So it's been 13 years. I was on it a decade when the book came out, and now we're 3 years in. So
you're like a fiscal Simon Wiesenthal or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, a dream job, really. Yeah.
And you know, in this book, you kind of focused on the five of the Germany's richest families, yeah. Which many of them are from the auto industry.
Now,
but of course, it's much wider issue than that,
sure.
Right?
Sure.
I mean, so how much of Germany's richest families would you say have got their wealth during the Nazi times, and how much is this recognized?
So actually, one of the myths that the book dispels is that they actually created their wealth during the Nazi era. They were wealthy far before that. You know, I mean, these families came up during the German Empire. They, became wealthy during World War I, during the Weimar Republic, during the Third Reich, in occupied Western Germany, in reunified Germany. So it really, the book really goes into kind of the continuation of money and power, you know, throughout the 155 years of Germany. With the exception of one family in the book, which is the Porsche-Piëch family, which controls Volkswagen, Porsche, Audi, Skoda, Seat, Bentley, Lamborghini, and a few other car and motor brands. They really laid the foundation of their wealth during the Third Reich with the Porsche at the time. It was actually a car factory or car design bureau. It was that's more accurate. Mm-hmm. And of course, the being tasked with creating the Volkswagen, Ferdinand Porsche did.
I mean, a lot of the five families that you looked into were car. Are now car.
Are now car, yes.
But they weren't at the time?
They weren't at the time, no. Again, with the exception of the Porsche Piëchs, with Ferdinand Porsche being the one, together with his son-in-law Anton Piëch, and a Jewish co-founder named Adolf Rosenberger, founded the Porsche car design firm in Stuttgart in 1930, pushed Adolf Rosenberger out for being a Jew in 1935, scrubbed him from company history, and then became successful, or was tasked by Hitler to design and create Volkswagen.
Hitler was a bit of a car nut, wasn't he?
He was a total car nut. He idealized Henry Ford, and vice versa. When he gave the when he tasked Ferdinand Porsche to create the Volkswagen, another task that he gave was, of course, building the well-known car factory in Wolfsburg, what at the time was the largest car factory in Europe, which was very much modeled after the River Rouge, a car factory of Ford in Detroit, in the greater Detroit area, in Dearborn, Michigan.
Which is, actually. And of course, you could argue that Nazi auto industrialists are not really a thing of the past anymore, right?
One could say that, the historical comparison isn't quite apt yet, but it certainly looks to be heading a certain direction. He's not shy to use his arms, let's put it that way.
Exactly. I won't demonstrate on camera.
Yeah, please don't.
What we're talking about. Yeah. So, in the You spent 4 years researching this book, building on contacts that you had as a Bloomberg reporter, business reporter, getting all kinds of access into these kind of family Stiftungen in Germany. What kind of influence do these Stiftungen, like institutions, funds have? Because and quite often they go towards right-wing politics, right?
I mean, let's back up a little bit and I'll talk a little bit about how I came on this topic, because that's, I think, very... We can see, the viewer and listener can see the bigger picture. You know, when I started at Bloomberg News in late 2011, actually in the New York Bureau, on an investigative team which focused on hidden wealth and non-stock exchange listed companies, because there was a blind spot for Bloomberg. Mm. And they soon asked me, because I'm Dutch, if I could write about the German-speaking companies and the German-speaking world, the German-speaking family-owned businesses, family offices, etc. Mm. And, you know, my American boss, this Dutch guy, I'm sure he speaks fluent German. So what I would, which I did not at the time. So what I would do is I would go from New York, I would spend a month, a year between Thanksgiving and Christmas, going to the Bloomberg bureaus in Germany, Switzerland and Austria. And the stories that I would always come back with were this mix of the financial and the historical and the business side of things.
But you mean like, by historical, you mean kind of Nazi? Historical.
Exactly, yeah. But Nazi historical, exactly. Yeah. And what struck me in my reporting was that companies like BMW and Porsche, but particularly the families that control them, like the BMW Quants and the Porsche Piers, would celebrate their fathers and grandfathers for their business successes through massive media prizes, massive global charitable foundations, you know, corporate headquarters, museums, academic chairs, you name it, named after these men, but leave out any kind of mention of their mass war crimes, their Nazi affiliations during the Third Reich and after. Mm. And after they had purported to have reckoned with these crimes. And I thought that was such a whitewash. And that's such a brazen distortion of history that I wanted to shine a light on it. And that's what the initial Bloomberg articles did about the Quant dynasty, which is still today Germany's most wealthiest and arguably most influential economically, politically, financial business dynasty. They control the BMW group. About the Flick dynasty, which controlled Daimler-Benz. Mm. And of course, the patriarch Friedrich Flick was sentenced for war crimes and crimes against humanity at Nuremberg. About the Utker dynasty, whose patriarch Rudolf August Utker was an SS officer who was trained in Dachau concentration camp and was really a family of ideological Nazis during the Third Reich. Mm. And then, you know, after these articles, people were saying, hey, you should write a book about this. So I ended up moving from New York to Berlin in October 27 and spending four and a half years doing the research from Berlin, you know, going through archives, speaking to sources, you know, not only in Germany, but Europe and North America wide. Both primary and secondary sources. And indeed, I mean, it was really, the starting point of the book was really contemporary. Was this contemporary whitewash? Was this, saying, oh, we have this academic study of 1,200 pages where all the details are in, you know, after some scandal breaks about, you know, beloved company X or beloved patriarch Z, and to kind of pacify it, what the German modus operandi is to say, we're going to open our archives, we're going to commission a historian to go through everything. And then, you know, you don't hear about it for 4 or 5 years. And of course, then a study is published, which is 1,200 pages of dense academic German. And, you know, it never reaches a wide audience. You know, it's only discussed in academic circles. Yeah. The historians do a great job. That's not, you know, this is very important to say this, right? But you know, you're dealing with a German public which is desensitized and inundated with this topic, right? So in a way, it's a very clever way of saying, of putting it on the shelf, saying it's all, the details are all in there, but they never reach a wider audience within Germany, let alone outside of Germany, because there's no translations, right? So on a consumer level, on the websites of these BMW Foundation, Herbert Quandt, or the Herbert Quandt Media Prize,
yeah,
or the Ferry Porsche Foundation, or the Rudolf August Oetker Foundation, or the Friedrich Flick Foundation, they can just pretend that these were just very successful businessmen and leave out any, you know, leave out, again, any trace of their mass war crimes and their exploitations of hundreds of thousands of men, women and children, and their robberies, the theft of Jewish-owned businesses and businesses in German-occupied territories, and their contribution to mass armaments production.
I mean, it's almost become like an internet meme.
Right.
Don't ask a German company what they were doing between 33 and 45, right?
Yeah.
Because in a sense, they were all somewhat kind of involved in Nazi war crimes. And I think one thing that gets left out of many histories of the Second World War is how much forced labor there was and slave labor.
Huge. I mean, it was between 12 and 20 million Europeans were deported to Germany, you know, to be men, women and children to be enslaved in German factories and mines, of which an approximate 2 million died, you know, as, you know, human beings died as, you know, being exploited as forced and slave laborers.
Yeah.
And so it's a really massive, massive amount.
Exactly. And I think, you know, often because maybe because these histories are written from a US or UK perspective and we didn't experience that. And,
right.
You know, so a lot like Serbians, Ukrainians, right, and people are left out of those histories of these huge companies, household names like Volkswagen, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that was really important to me, actually. And I think I'm really glad to see that the book has been translated into many different Eastern European languages, because, you know, one of the things that, you know, the heirs of, you know, people who were enslaved or who were exploited as forced and slave laborers, you know, they don't have access in their own language to the details to what happened to their families, like to the bigger picture, right? And I think, you know, for me, it was really important to get the story out on a global scope, but also really to the countries, like, you know, there's an edition in Ukrainian, in Czech, in Bulgarian, in Croatian.
But do Germans know about this stuff? About the forced labor, to the extent that it happened? Because I think there's a bit of myth-making around this.
Huge. Massively.
There's even, in some cases, a bit of a developing cottage industry of, like, they publish these huge academic studies about how awful things are, but then there's actually these kind of romance novels, almost, about certain dynasties that Köln Haferflocken. There's a couple of new books that have come out in recent years where they almost romanticize some of this stuff. In the Köln case, I mean, he was a Nazi. They say he was forced into it. Romanticization of this Mittelstand and some kind of quiet resistance to the Nazis.
I mean, the romanticization of the Mittelstand or of German industry and economy, as you know, and particularly the car industry as the backbone of German economy. I mean, that has been going on for decades, right? Ever since the so-called, Wirtschaftswunder, Wirtschaftswunder, economic miracle, which in a way was not a miracle at all, because there was just a continuation of money and power from the Third Reich to West Germany, and, you know, the Allied occupation authorities, where they could have done a good, where they couldn't have done a proper job by at least overseeing the denazification proceedings, you know, they decided that not only did they hand over hundreds of thousands of suspected Nazi war criminals and ardent Nazi sympathizers back to West German authorities, who of course had no incentive to judge their fellow compatriots on crimes that they had, you know, committed themselves and sympathies that they had held or still held.
I mean, wasn't there a case where a CEO was actually, like, put before a committee and judged by employees of his own?
Yeah, exactly. It was in Oetker. It was in the Oetker case, yes, right? Who was, a voluntary SS officer who was trained in Dachau concentration camp.
It was almost mafia-esque, actually.
I mean, yeah, it was just a farce. It was just...
But what about denazification?
No, denazification was a farce. The second myth I tried to dispel with this book, is that, you know, denazification never occurred. For sure not in Western Germany. different case in Eastern Germany, where not only were the industrialists wholesale expropriated, but you know, and also often just, you know, extrajudicially executed, but there was also a far more thorough denazification. But in addition to also appropriating former Gestapo officers into the Stasi, let's not forget that. But they, you know, I was once sternly corrected when I said that East Germany didn't do a good job at denazification, and I read it up a little bit, and it actually turned out that they, you know, particularly compared to the West, did. And there, of course, you know, back to the point about the continuation of money and power from the Third Reich to Western Germany, the Allies. Just the Allied occupation authorities, you know, in a Cold War context, just let all the industrialists, the financiers, CEOs, business heirs keep everything. I mean, the only company which was broken up was IG Farben, which was broken up into...
Which famously created Cyclone B.
Yes, exactly.
The gas used in Auschwitz and concentration camps.
Yeah. And, you know, it was broken up into BASF, which is now one of the largest chemical companies in the world. Broken up into Bayer, which is one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world, and broken up into Hoechst, which was an industrial company. It was also a massive conglomerate. Mm. The three of them, you know, by themselves, right? But there was no, you know, everything they had robbed, everything they had earned, you know, they weren't, you know, they could just keep everything in West Germany, and that really formed the basis of this so-called Wirtschaftswunder, you know, was just that they could keep everything, and that if you were a family which had been robbed of their shares or their assets or their businesses, they just had to initiate restitution claims, and they would be fought tooth and nail by the industrialists and the business patriarchs and their lawyers.
You mean if you were a Jewish family?
Yeah, Jewish family, or exactly.
So, of course, a lot of Jewish families didn't survive or didn't want to come back to Germany necessarily.
Well, no, but it's not about coming back to Germany. Mm. You know, those heirs that managed to flee in time to settle in North America or in Israel or elsewhere on the globe, you know, they initiated restitution proceedings if they were robbed, and they were fought tooth and nail as well. And I mean, there's still many restitution cases going on, particularly regarding real estate and art to this day. I mean, I speak with restitution lawyers quite frequently, and it's, you know...
What do they say the response even today from the German authorities is like?
Well, it's difficult, right? Because the successor state now is the Federal Republic now was created only 35 years ago. So it's really the restitution case is really, you know, so many of them, it only restarted after reunification.
Right.
So that's why, of course, many of them are ongoing, are still ongoing, and I mean it's something that we'll be reading about for the next decades to come.
Yeah, really. Although you don't read about it that much in the German press, you know, I read German news all the time, and these topics are kind of left out in a lot of cases. There are some exceptions. This documentary, The Silence of the Kvants, in the 2000s, and your book got quite a good reception here as well. But why do you think that is? This lack of focus on, you know, the continuity of the business elite. Like, we talk about BMW and BMW and Volkswagen quite a lot, but actually the Nazi past of it is treated as a kind of irrelevance or just an uncomfortable irrelevance.
Well, I mean, you have to decouple them, right? Because the Quants, the BMW Quants, didn't own BMW during the Third Reich, right? They only came to own it after the war, with the money, you know, in a sense that they were allowed to keep during the 1950s.
Right, so BMW,
but Daimler as well, but Volkswagen, right? Volkswagen is the example. Is the Volkswagen is really the exception, right? Mm. Because you know, the car industry is the backbone of German industry. Really, is something that came out from the in the 1950s, and again, this whole myth of the Wirtschaftswunder, of the economic miracle, you know, the Quants and the Flicks were able to invest in BMW and Daimler because they were allowed to keep everything of the profits that they had, you know, from the Third Reich and before that. Again, they were very wealthy, wealthy dynasties. But, you know, the families are really focused on in the book are those that are still Germany's wealthiest today. And, you know, the criteria were really that, first of all, they had to be influential on both on a financial, economic, and political level to an extent today with their consumer-facing companies like BMW or Porsche or Dr. Oetker. But also, there had to be continuation, right? Because often people ask me why aren't the Krupps or the Thyssens in the books? Because they've died out. They're no they're not a relevant actor in German business as families anymore, right? But I really focus on the families as opposed to kind of the brands themselves.
Fair. But it's not just about business influence, right? Because there's also political influence.
Totally, sure. I mean, the BMW Quants are the largest supporters. So Susanne Klatten and her brother Stefan Quant, the wealthiest heirs in Germany, are also the biggest donors to the CDU and have been for decades. So, you know, that's one. I mean, they're establishment conservatives, right?
I mean, CDU is part of the party as well. Of German business.
Exactly. It has been. And the party of German corruption, too. So they go hand in hand often. I mean, every decade there's a huge scandal surrounding the CDU, another CDU corruption scandal and these things. Most notably, the Flick affair. Of the 1980s, the billionaire Flick heir, paid bribes to the CDU, the SPD, and the FDP, and the only ones which had clean hands were the Green Party, which then ended up leading the inquiry into the entire Flick affair, which is still in post-war Germany the biggest corruption scandal to date. And it's
and it's often quite enmeshed, all right, these business and state structures. It's in some cases it's almost like corporatist model, particularly in Volkswagen, which is I think 20% owned by the state of Lower Saxony.
Yeah, but in a way that's also a let's take the positive view, right? That's also a way to guard workers' interests, and that they're not completely held over by the Porsche Piers. Who lord over it from tax-friendly Austria. So in a way, that is, I regard that participation more as a positive, as a bulwark against the family interests rather than a negative, I would say.
Okay. I mean, I think it can definitely have those positive kind of aspects of Mitbestimmung, of kind of participation, but then also it does mean that you're getting into bed together and you effectively have the same interests, which might make sense for such a big industry like that and such a big employer. But what about, since the book came out, I think last year you wrote a story about a study, one of these studies that was commissioned but didn't come out. That was about
I wrote a story about Klaus-Michael Kühne, who's Germany's wealthiest man, who's the largest shareholder of Lufthansa, of he's the main financier of HSV, the Hamburg soccer club. He's the large shareholder of Hapag-Lloyd, which is one of the largest shipping companies in the world. And he's the largest shareholder of Kühne Nagel, which is the largest, one of the largest transport companies in the world. Logistics companies in the world, I must say. And he is 87. He gave another big interview to Spiegel yesterday, where they also confront him with my findings. He's 87. He's Germany's richest man. He has an estimated net worth of 45 billion, although people close to him estimated closer to 50 and 60 billion, because he's been buying billions of real estate in recent years throughout Germany. And he doesn't have any heirs. He's Germany's richest man, doesn't have any heirs. He got married in his 50s with a woman of the same age. They never had children. So when he dies, and he's turning 88 in June, his entire private fortune, tens of billions, will be left over to the Kühne Foundation, his family foundation, and will be the largest privately held foundation in Europe and one of the largest in the world. And Klaus-Michael Kühne, was also, an only child. His father and uncle They ran Kühne and Nagel during the Third Reich. They first pushed out their Jewish shareholder, Adolf Maas, who ended up being murdered together with his wife, Katte, in Auschwitz. And, you know, then, and very early on, they pushed him out on April 3rd, 1933. And and subsequently, they participated in the so-called Emmachshon. Kühne and Nagel had the quasi-monopoly on the transportation of goods of Jews who had been deported to concentration and extermination camps from the Netherlands, from Belgium, from Luxembourg, from France. Mm. And Kühne and Nagel transported all of the good, their robbed goods from their houses to Germany to be auctioned off here. And to be auctioned off here for a fire sale, on a fire sale price, or to for those families that that had been the victim of Allied bombings. Mm. And so they participated, really, they really directly profited from the Shoah. And, you know, Klaus-Michael Kühne has refused any kind of reckoning, not only with the Aryanization of Adolf Maas, the pushing out of Adolf Maas from Kühne and Nagel, but also with the mass profiteering of his father and uncle from the Shoah through the Emmachshon. And in 2015, Klaus-Michael Kühne commissioned a study to the Handelsblatt Research Institute to celebrate the 125 years of Kühne and Nagel, when the Handelsblatt Research Institute researchers included a chapter, and they spent a year researching it, included a chapter on the activity of his company and his father and his uncle during the Third Reich. He said, my father was not a Nazi, and the study, 180 pages, is going under scroll and key, and is never to be seen. So he's, this is, you know, we were talking about, I think Kühne is really emblematic of the refusal to reckon of Germany's wealthiest with the past by just, you know, commissioning a study and putting it on a lock and key and saying, I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want to know anything. I don't want to see anything. And nothing ever happened. My father was a good man and he was not a Nazi.
I mean, in a sense, you can understand the individual Kühne's response for this, right? Like, it's his family. It's very uncomfortable. But my question is, why does society accept this? Your story came. Why does it need a, you know? Why did you need a Dutch journalist working for an American company? It was published also in Jacobin, which, you know, we're big fans of Jacobin. We had the editor in chief on the podcast, but it's not, you know, the Süddeutsche Zeitung or,
you know. One thing that I've learned about Germany is that it's deeply conservative and provincial at its core, and it's a country where power is not easily assailed. Its power is, you know, people are afraid of power in a way, you know, and for a German reporter or writer to engage in this story or spend 4 years on this. You know, because I was as surprised as you as well. Why hasn't anybody else written this book, right? You know, these families, the BMW Quants, or, you know, the Porsche Piers, or the Utkers, or the Von Finks, or the Flicks, or the Kühnes, can turn around and say, you know, what did your father and grandfather do during the Third Reich, and who are you to question us, basically, because, and that's really, you know, it's a deeply hierarchical society still, and a deeply conservative one, where, again, power is not easily assailed. And I think it is hard for there's this German saying, you know, it's not only a German saying, you know, don't throw stones at a glass house, right? I mean, that's really, in German society, that's really something where these crimes and the Third Reich is the crimes of the Third Reich are memorialized on a societal level, right? On a macro level, you know, Vergangenheitsbewältigung, Aufarbeitung, you name it.
Memorialized.
On a micro level, on a family level, it's still very, very hard to discuss it, even in our generation, you know, about what Opapa and Oma did. During the Third Reich. And Reschke Fernseher, the ARD program, just did a fantastic episode on Kühne, on Klaus-Michael Kühne and his suppression of the war crimes of his family and his company. And also found new material, internal emails. But they also really explained it very well to the German public about this kind of this, you know, this discrepancy between macro remembrance and micro remembrance, which isn't really happening, which is a discussion that's still not happening on a micro level in German society.
Yeah, I actually once applied for a fellowship to build some kind of tool to help people mm-hmm. look into that. And then I found out afterwards that the Stiftung, the institution that I applied for, was actually the money had come from a sort of Nazi dynasty, but that had Aryanized, as in stolen this company from the Jewish owner. And then the Stiftung, they had renamed it after the person who they had stolen it from. Yeah. So it's kind of, even the Stiftung was whitewashing.
No, I mean, that's really, I mean, that happens so often, right? I mean, so many of these foundations, of the Stiftung, they are still covering up their past, and they are using it in a very perverse way, where they are, you know, naming it after the person they stole it from,
but not show
the history of how they stole it from that person. I mean, that's really kind of, you know, the perverse way of dealing with it, because, you know, in German society, there's still this sense of die wollen es nicht wahrhaben. They don't want it to be true, right? Mm-hmm. In a way, they just wanted they still want to sweep it under the carpet, because the confrontation, which is a very painful one.
For sure.
But, you know, the argument in my book is really one for radical transparency, you know. I think it's very hard, you know, it's easier to enact change with public actors, right? With getting street names changed or getting
building a memorial.
Or building a memorial, exactly. But with private actors, like these powerful families, right? You know, I think what the book argues for is really quite minimal. Is not, you know, you don't have to pay any money. You know, you just have to be transparent about history, because you can only learn from history by showing the good and the bad. Yeah. Now, if you don't want to subject to that, you know, you should rename your foundations and your media prizes. You know, but the demand is radical transparency for people to learn from history.
And that's actually maybe my sort of criticism of your book, because it effectively, what you're asking, which sounds quite simple, is for the companies in many cases to just update their website, right? But couldn't we go further? Couldn't we go a lot further and say...
Okay, yeah, how further?
Couldn't we say that, you know, reparations for the descendants of slave labor victims of slave labor and forced labor to be given, for example, shares in Volkswagen.
Oh, that's an interesting.
Yeah, because I remember when I moved here, which would have been when you were here. There was this case of Kevin Kühnert. He was saying, like, why don't the workers own BMW?
I'm
like, oh, sure. Yeah. Why don't the workers, but then also the descendants, the people who work there and were forced to work there? Because what you're arguing for is a great journalistic kind of project.
Well, I am a journalist.
Exactly, yes, right? Yes. Yeah. And this is more political. Like, we see Germany.
We don't do politics.
Sure. But we see Germany. So we see this continuity of, like, this. It was very rich and powerful.
Right.
Started the Second World War, you know, created unimaginable amounts of destruction, enslaved so many people, and killed also so many. But what we're dealing with afterwards is just this kind of hush-hush culture of silence around stuff. And I agree that we should break the culture of silence, but shouldn't we also go further and expropriate at least the wealth that was, you know, built during that time? Of course, you said at the start of this interview that it wasn't, in most cases, started during the Nazi times. But
exactly, how are you going to extract it? Like, how are you going to quantify that? That's impossible.
It's an impetus,
right? Perhaps not an impetus I would agree with, but you know, agree to disagree.
The Stiftung of Kühnert, right? Why couldn't that go to the people who were Aryan?
Exactly. Okay, so now we're getting that. But for example, Klaus-Michael Kühnert just announced he's donating 330 million euros to build a new opera in Hamburg, which is where he's from and which is where most of his companies are based in.
Yeah. But
The proposals now to have a wing named after if he needs to build a new opera for Hamburg, which you know they need more money for social stuff, but Allah, you know, let them at least name a wing after Katern Adolf Maas, for example, right, or name the square in front of the new opera, like, remember, you know, remember the victims of those families. That's perhaps a demand that he would, that he may. It's, I don't realistic. Think he will be open for it, but who knows? Yeah. You know, but that's a small thing. To your point, you know, there will be, after Kühne dies in a not so distant future, you know, there will be 60 billion euros in a privately held foundation, right? Mm. How will that reckoning be? How will that money, which, and really you can see from the profits that his father and uncle made, that they, you know, really, that they really exponentially made, you know, they exponentially built their fortunes during the Third Reich, during the World War II, during the Amokshon, right? Mm. How will that money, in a way, go towards reckoning or go towards some sort of reconciliation with the past, right? Of course, there has been a big reparations payments already that happened in Germany through the EFOUT set of surviving former forced and slave laborers. But, you know, this is a discussion to be had. And by the way, the Kevin Kühnert comments back then in 2019 led to Verena Baalzen respond to Kühnert at the same marketing conference and led to the whole scandal of Verena Baalzen making her comments to Bild about how in her family business forced and slave laborers were treated as well as were treated as well as German employees. So
which is obviously nonsense.
Which is totally nonsense. Which led to a massive scandal. Led to the Baalzens commissioning a study, which was just published a year ago. Her doing many mea culpas, being really kind of shamed.
Yeah,
and unfortunately providing a great introduction to my book. Mm. But you know,
The sort of smugness, which I've seen a video of the conference, and she says, like, you know, I own a quarter of Baalzen, and it's good, like, that's good, so, and I like to, you know, have my yachts and stuff.
But that was facetious, right? I mean, it was in response to Kühnert. Then her follow-up comments to Bild were just, you know, incredibly ill-informed. But you know, in a way, it also gives you a bit of a glimpse in how these families think.
Very insulated, right?
Super insulated. I mean, you know, you get a sense of the BMW quants and families like them, that they just have yes men and women running around, you know, and that they don't get any kind of they don't have any kind of confrontation with reality, because, you know, in this day and age, you know, to be so tone deaf, to have Germany's highly paid media prize named after a man who built a concentration camp in German occupied Poland, you know, who exploited thousands of forced and slave laborers, including female concentration camp captives, in a battery factory in Berlin Niederschöne Weide, a man who, you know, acquired companies stolen from Jews in France, to have that on Germany, have his name celebrated in relation to Germany's highest, most paid journalism prize is totally perverse, and goes a long way to explaining how how out of touch with reality they are. And BMW also carries this man's name. Slogan: inspire responsible leadership, right? You know, in the name of Nazi war criminal. Exactly, exactly.
It's insane. Yeah. You're talking about the Herbert Quandt, Herbert Media Prize, and it is very established. And you get people like Tanit Koch, former editor-in-chief of Bild, very established journalists sit on the board of these media prizes. It's very clubby. It's very, establishment. And then when it comes to someone wearing a Palestinian scarf or something, that's where they're like, oh, that's a symbol of anti-Semitism. But
this is the culmination of the German, of the Deutsche Doppelmoral, of German hypocrisy. You have people like Tanit Koch, the former editor-in-chief of Bild, and Jan-Erik Peters, the former publisher of NZ, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, and of Welt. You have the editor-in-chief of Wirtschaftswoche on that jury, the woman who runs ZDF Phoenix, together with Germany's richest heir. You know, Tanit Koch and Jan-Erik Peters tweet about anti-Semitism and about Israel and about how good of a friends of the Jews they are. At the same time, they hand out a media prize in the name of a Nazi war criminal every year. you know, and that for me is really kind of, that is the culmination of Deutsche Doppelmoral, really, to have it both ways. You can't have it both ways, but in Germany apparently you can.
Yeah, and you actually have a personal link to these stories as well, right? Two of your grandfathers lived under German occupation.
Right, I mean, you know, our, you know, like many tens of millions of Europeans, you know, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, tried to sail to England to join the Royal Air Force together with his best friend, and on the second try, their sailboat, that he was a very avid sailor, was blown back to shore, and they were arrested by German soldiers in the occupied Netherlands. And he was 25 years old, and he was sentenced as a political prisoner to 22 months, you know, and he was exploited as a slave laborer in a steel factory in Bochum. I still haven't found out which one or to which family it belonged to. It's still actually something I really want to do. And, you know, I think the stories of my grandparents really informed me about the history. It's not the reason I wrote the book, I mean, but it certainly informed me about how important it is to own up to history. You know, what I'm arguing for is not much. Is own up to your history, be honest about your history, you know, and you know, it's a minimal ask, I would say. And but they still steadfastly refuse and gives to these really weird, perverse situations like the annual handing out of the Herbert Quandt Media Prize, which gets weirder and weirder with every year. And the biographer of de Quandt, Rüdiger Jongbloed, wrote a fantastic article on Übermedien about the problems surrounding that article, and I suggest everybody should read it. Mm. And I also would strongly urge any German journalist not to accept that prize.
Mm. And what about, because I think there's this level of, you know, they also seem to lecture you sometimes, you know, there's a certain sort of superiority, yeah, of like, you know, we've learned from our history. Yeah. Do you think they have?
Sometimes? I think as in most societies around the world, right? I think it is often, you know, with these families, right? They pay lip service to Germany's, you know, rightfully lauded memorial culture, but they think that the rules of society don't apply to them. They think they can say one thing and do another, and that's really what the book is about, is kind of uncovering that hypocrisy, that contemporary hypocrisy, and showing the entire gruesome backstory to it. Mm. But you know what I always say is, or what I've come to find out, having lived here almost 5 years in the past, and having a lot of dear German friends as well, but going deep into the German soul, you know, there's this perverse mix of self-hatred and superiority that Germans wrestle with, and it's a very dangerous, combustible, violent mix, and it is perhaps what, you know, defines Germany, perhaps in a way, mm-hmm, but it is something that drives them forward, but also keeps them down, and also makes them explode in a way. It's a scary mix, and I think, you know, perhaps there will be a day where Germans will be a bit more at peace with themselves, and I think, mm-hmm, you know, having the most powerful actors in society taking transparent, honest steps towards that, you know, by being honest about our history, fully honest about our history, mm, I think will go some ways into making amends in addition to everything else.
Right, and I mean, it's not a conspiracy of silence, because there is the lip, right, service, as you put it. Maybe, right, maybe it's a conspiracy of lip service, but I think one of my criticisms, yeah, of the memory culture is actually this idea that we're all guilty, right?
Because, right,
and that the nation, yeah, itself is guilty, which is must be really hard to wrestle with, as you put it. But you know,
and it's also, you know,
because not everyone did.
No, I mean,
bad,
no, there,
right?
there were 10 million, you know, there were 10 million NSDAP, Nazi Party members.
Sure.
You
and,
know,
and so there were people who were more guilty, right? And then people,
exactly,
who
yeah, but
profited
again,
more. You
that is also, that is also nuances. Way. That is also Graufarm, all right? Yeah. You can't, but there is, you know, when you come to, I mean, the families I write about in my book, I mean, you're talking about people who business patriarchs who exploited tens of thousands, you know, in the case of the Quans, at least 60,000 forced and slave laborers. Mm-hmm. You know, they had sub-concentration camps on their factory complexes. You know, they were some of the largest profiteers of Aryanization, of expropriation, and some of the largest producers of weapons, right? I mean, these people, you know, those patriarchs were the ones who, you know, engaged in gross war crimes. That yeah. doesn't mean, you know, that doesn't...
And they're still, in many cases, the great and the good of German society.
Right.
Whereas, you know, your ordinary person who may not have had any involvement with the Nazis, their descendants are made to feel as guilty.
Right, in a way, exactly. That is, yes, that's a huge problem. And then I think, you know, the things that we're seeing, the troubling developments in German society, you know, with the rise of the AfD, is also a lot of people, you know, especially in former Eastern Germany, who were, you know, suppressed for decades, then incorporated without a kind of given second thoughts to them in a reunified Germany, left alone economically, and now are also still, you know, meant to feel something about a history that they had nothing or little to do with. And that's, of course, that is dangerous, yes. But, you know, again, it's the conversations that need to happen within German families that are really important also to reckon with it, as opposed to this kind of ceremonial or memorialized kind of macro reckoning that happens, you know, ad nauseum in German society, and that doesn't really change anything. That's really kind of perfunctional, you know, in a way.
Yeah, you're right. And so actually, these people who have a much more recent experience right. of a kind of communist socialist dictatorship, then this idea of memory culture actually only really started in earnest after reunification. But were there actually any changes in terms of the companies, in terms of the structures after that?
I mean,
or did the rich just get richer after unification?
I mean, I mean, you know, East Germany was wholesale kind of incorporated, and to an extent, you know, some argue by the Treuhand, also expropriated in a way, that all the wealth was lifted to the West and that they were left with nothing following reunification. And, you know, the economics figures borne out that to be true. And there's a lot of resentment. There's a lot of resentment about that. But of course, you know, the resentment is also having lived for decades under a, you know, under a totalitarian regime, and then, you know, and the freedoms of the West, and then of course the massive wealth discrepancies have also cost, of course, for you know, a very combustible mix today, which you're seeing in the rise of the AfD in the former East German states.
And there was actually one case, right, where one of these, you know, Nazi billionaires, to use your term, or their descendants, was kind of involved in funding some media companies that were supporting the AfD, right?
So August von Finck, which is the von Finck dynasty, which co-founded Allianz and Munich Re, two of the largest reinsurers then and today, globally. They also had a private bank called Merck Finck, which is a big private bank now owned by the Qataris. They sold it to Barclays, and then it was sold on to the Qataris. And they are Munich's largest landowners. And it was really the patriarch, August von Finck Sr., was really an ardent Nazi sympathizer, right? Most of the people in my book, or most of the patriarchs I write in my book, were really sheer opportunists. They wanted to expand their fortunes, you know, and also falling off the tail of the Great Depression, you know, political and economic volatile times. They also wanted to protect their businesses, but they wanted to expand their fortunes, expand their businesses. Hitler promised them economic stability, in which he also initially delivered on, with the greatest rearmament that Germany had seen to date. But most of them were opportunists. August von Finck Sr. was a convinced Nazi. Mm. You know, idealized Hitler. You know, blatant anti, you know, vicious anti-Semite. Profited of Aryanizing the Dreyfus Bank here in Berlin and of the Rothschild Bank in Vienna, which was never reconstituted after the war. And his son, August von Finck Jr., who died 3 years ago at the age of 91, really, and it's the only example in the book of continuation of kind of far-right political thinking within one dynasty, was rumored to be one of the main financiers of the AfD in its starting years. So partly 2013 when it was established, but particularly during the turn from anti-EU, anti-Europe party into anti-immigration party in 2015. There's still investigations going on about it, also by the public attorney of Berlin, because, you know, there were this kind of shady foundation funded all these, you know, all these political campaigns for the AfD in Baden-Württemberg, in Brandenburg. And then nobody found out who was behind it. There were millions spent in it. And the big suspicion said August von Finck Jr. and others were, and it Spiegel did great reporting on that.
Yeah. And zooming out a bit, how important are these political foundations? I mean, when I look at funding, it always seems to be Bosch or there's right. Stiftungs play such a big role in German political life, public life.
Because there's so much money in Germany, because, you know, we're talking about the third largest economy in the world.
Yeah, but I feel like in the UK, we don't have these same kind of constructs. A lot of it's more state or...
Yeah.
I mean, it's there, but it doesn't
again,
seem
I mean, prominent. I mean, this is literally because, you know, in a way, Great Britain kind of, you know, had its post-war economically decline, whereas Germany, again, because of the myth of the Wirtschaftswunder, only went up. And with that, so much wealth was... immense amount of wealth was created, right? And much of it was put into Stiftung because there weren't any heirs, like the Krupp Stiftung, for example.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's no heirs with the Krupp Stiftung, so they own 25% of ThyssenKrupp, which is worth billions and billions. And Bosch as well. Another example, no heirs. Right. So it's owned. The stake is owned by a foundation.
And so then there's a continuity, not a family. It's not a family dynasty, but the influence of these Nazi companies then continues on Germany.
Well, I don't know. I mean, again, these are companies that were built prior to the Third Reich. So we call them Nazi companies. That's a bit harsh, but, you know, certainly companies that greatly profited off of the Third Reich. Right. But of course, there's also business continuity because they hold the shares that and they get dividends. And I mean, there's a certain stability and continuity with having a foundation, keeping 25% of the shares, having a board that oversees it. And it's also a little inflexible. It's also very German, very kind of a bit old fashioned. But yeah, they play a major role in German business and of course on society level in funding many things.
Yeah, and imagine if they then put those funds and dividends into funding, you know, reparations for victims of their crimes across Europe and even the wider world. So, David Jeong, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been great. Been wanting to do this interview for years. So, thank you.
Thank you, James. It was a pleasure.